This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have time today to talk with the Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman about some interesting developments that have come about involving the city of Gary government, as well as some other topics involving not only the city of Gary, but politics in general. And Ruth, as always, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm ready to roll.
Go right ahead.
For the last decade or more, a group of people in Gary and in Northwest Indiana as a whole have been fighting for what's called a community benefits agreement. This is an agreement that usually is signed with developers where they say, okay, we're going to come in, we're going to get tax abatements, we're going to take this land on the cheap, and we're going to build something. The community benefit agreement says, well, you have to hire some people here who live in Gary. Not only that, you have to invest in training. And finally, because your development will have an impact on the surrounding community, you have to set aside a percentage of dollars to invest in that community, say, improve a park or pave a road or something like that. But in the last year, December 2019, the city of Gary actually passed an ordinance for community benefits agreement. Now, like any ordinance, it had a lot of bumps and holes in it. But when Mayor Jerome Prince took over, he came out pretty publicly and said that community benefits agreements are bad for business. Many of the city council members have strongly disagreed with him, because what's good for Gary matters more than what's good for business. Part of the thinking on this is that who's going to want to come to Gary? But we have lakefront, trains, airport. We have uninhabited land, lots of open space. And we also have national park reserves. We're a very biodiverse area, and so actually, given the surrounding communities, we have a lot to offer. This came back up again when Broadway Loft said they wanted to build some units of housing, apartments, on Broadway, and they would build 38 apartments, and it would be for young professionals. But they didn't know about the CBA, community benefits agreement, because the government forgot to tell them. So since then, there's been jockeying. There was an attempt at the last city council meeting to repeal the community benefits ordinance, but 6-2, it was voted down. I now think the vote would be 7-1. But we are revising and debating with the city council, and this Tuesday, they're going to take a vote on a new edition of the ordinance that takes some of what the committee wants, some of what the council wants, some of what various political units want. But it is looking like we will have a community benefits agreement that at least holds developers accountable for hiring locally and investing in more than their own project. So we'll see. I just sent some amendments out to the city council because there are some contradictions in the current language. But we're hoping this Tuesday, and you should join the Zoom council meeting to find out what in fact happens with our community benefits ordinance.
Does it seem that this revised ordinance is going to be a better one than the original?
It has some better clarification than the original, but there's been a real debate over whether the mayor or the common council really makes the decisions about it. And, of course, the mayor doesn't like it at all, but the common council now really wants it. But the question has been who's going to oversee it, who's going to appoint members of a community benefits commission, and this new language clarifies that, although it leaves, I would say, a few major garage doors open for the city to back down. And so we're still in negotiations, but it's a big step forward for the city of Gary, because if you look at the developments that have gone on, The people in Gary have not gotten jobs. The communities have been affected but not helped. And so there's some hopefulness right now on that score.
One of the other points that has come up recently in the debate, I guess, within the Redevelopment Commission, maybe not much further than that, but it turned out to be publicly announced, was some disposition concerning Gleason Park, the golf course, and the property that's not very far from IU Northwest.
It's across the street from IU. It's smack in the middle of a major residential area and a stable residential area. And the Redevelopment Committee actually tried to vote on it the same day that people got copies of what the developer wanted. And there's a couple problems. One is they wanted them to vote on it without knowing how the land would be used.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of Redevelopment Commission members voted against it for that reason, because there was no idea what are they going to build there. But then the head of the commission said, well, look, they're going to pay $9 million, and they're not asking for anything. As if, you know, all we need is money. So what if, in fact, what they're thinking of, light industry or logistics would go there? That would mean enormous amount of traffic, trucks, cars, pollution, right in the middle of a residential area across the street from our prized university. I'm surprised that we haven't heard from IU on this yet, because it will require major zoning changes. And I can't believe the university wants either a factory or a garage right across the street.
Mm-hmm.
It would affect air quality. It would affect traffic. It would certainly degrade the housing stock in the community around it, which is, like I said, very good housing and a stable community. So I actually will be talking to a member of the commission in the next day or two to see if I can get more information. But I think the idea that $9 million with no strings attached is great for the city is the same argument that the mayor used on the CBA. We can't ask developers anything. We should just take their money, take their investment, and let them do whatever they want. And that will destroy our city.
I know one other point that we brought up in the past deals with the issue of immigration here in Northwest Indiana. And there's been a lengthy debate. There's been decisions made on a national level that have impact locally. And one of the decisions has been involved with bringing immigration detainees from places like over in Illinois to the Gary Chicago International Airport to get them sent back to wherever that happens to be. And I guess I understand there have been some changes, but what seems to be the latest that we can't seem to find out much about at the airport?
Well, I would entitle this section, "What Are They Hiding?"
Okay.
Because I go every Friday to the airport. So far, I haven't been totally alone. But for weeks, we were being harassed by Gary Police. Now, Gary Police should not be policing the airport because the airport has its own internal security. Plus, the city of Gary is a welcoming city and should not be using police to protect ICE and deportation flights. But this is what happens. All of the people who are detained come in from Illinois. Right now they're coming from Broadview, from the prison there. And they arrive sometimes a school bus with some vans, sometimes a long van with some shorter vans, and they arrive at about 10 o'clock. At 10:30, a plane arrives from Brownsville, Texas, to pick up the people, but it takes them to Louisiana, which means they're not going back to Mexico. Most of the Louisiana flights go either to Honduras or Guatemala, the two most dangerous countries in the hemisphere, possibly in the whole world. And so they are continuing these deportations. I managed to get some photos. I've had two professional photographers come in to help, but they block us. A couple weeks ago, I had a police officer from Gary tell me that everything at the airport was private property. Now, my state representative and an attorney, Reagan Hatcher, told me parking in front of the administration building is like parking in front of City Hall. It's not private. It's completely public because our tax money paid for that. But they would not let me park there. And at one point, this police shouted at me that I was violating an order. And when I asked him to please tell me what the order was, he shouted even louder, "Get away from my car." So I sent a note to the mayor, and I'm happy to report that this past week there were no police cars because I said I was going to file a harassment complaint. But this time, not only did they use oil tankers and trucks from the airport to block our view, they actually used small planes. So the view was blocked 360 degrees. Only straight above could a photo be taken. So my question continues to be, why are they hiding this? If this is legal and above board, why are they so insistent that the public not know or see what's happening? And I think it's because there is so much mistreatment going on with these flights. 2 weeks ago, they canceled the flight because of the hurricane storms in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And what ICE did was they moved all their airplanes to Texas for safekeeping. But the detention center in Louisiana became flooded with feces and urine, and they didn't do anything to help the people. So this process is cruel, inhumane, and unaccountable because they are hiding something, and we would like to know what that is. I will continue to go every Friday because I feel someone should witness this cruelty. Because most of the people that are being deported are not criminals. Criminals are in jail. They are people who are here sometimes for 10, 20, 30 years, and they don't have documents. And their families are being torn apart. Their neighborhoods are being threatened with roundups. And it's creating unsafe conditions, especially during this coronavirus pandemic. And the number of cases in detention have skyrocketed.
Well, Ruth, one of the other points that you would like to bring up today, I know, is about a couple anniversaries, one of which is an election of someone in Central America. And the other
one
is South America, excuse me. And the other is a special anniversary of how the U.S. was involved in some matters. Bring us up to date on those, please.
Well, this is going to give my age away, Chris.
Okay.
But I was an assistant professor back in 1972 when I went to the country of Chile, where for the first time ever, a socialist was elected president of the country. It was an extraordinary experience because I was able to see workers running factories, workers controlling the farmland that they plowed. People were building health clinics and housing. And Allende, the president, Salvador Allende, was a medical doctor. And he promised to get rid of poverty and to give people a chance to participate in government. This sent Richard Nixon, our president, and his first advisor, Henry Kissinger, into great tumult because they were still thinking Cuba and that somehow this was the domino effect and the U.S. would lose control. What they really feared was that U.S. corporations would lose the ability to exploit the natural and human resources of the country. And so from before the election, the U.S. was sending millions of dollars into Chile to try to prevent Allende from getting elected. And then once he was elected, they actually carried out the assassination of the chief of staffs of the military because he was what's called a constitutionalist. He would not have agreed to overthrow Allende, who was democratically elected. But that will happen just 3 years later. So on September 11th, same date, September 11th, the U.S. Armed, trained, and facilitated a brutal military coup. They bombed the city of Santiago. They arrested hundreds of thousands of people. Tens of thousands disappeared. Their bodies were dropped into the Pacific Ocean. They were buried in the Atacama Desert. And up to today, the economy has only served U.S. and elite interests, which is why last November, October, some people might have read, students and labor, and women especially, took to the streets demanding a change in their country. And it was very similar to the Black Lives Matter movement here, because, it was outrage at the lack of rights and decency and a livable standard for life. And also, it represented an incredible coalition of forces saying that you can't just kill us, repress us, imprison us, and torture us. One of the lessons I learned, which I'll end on, was Allende said there is a peaceful path here. We are not going to make war. We are going to do these changes peacefully. But the U.S. corporations, the U.S. government, and the filthy rich people of Chile said, not on my watch. And so they basically unleashed a counter-revolution while the people of Chile were peacefully trying to change their country. I want to point out that today's Black Lives Matter protests are 91 to 95% totally peaceful, but they have been attacked violently by white supremacists, by police, sheriffs, and even some military people. And so it's very important that we understand that peaceful protest means that both sides are peaceful. And you can't have a peaceful protest when you are being tear gassed, fired on, white supremacists killing your protesters. And so we have to educate ourselves and really be cautious about the threat to our democracy.
Well, Ruth Needleman, thanks for spending time with us to go over these points. And we hope to hear more about some of the changes that may come in Common Council about the Community Benefits Agreement. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Sure thing. Talk soon. Take care.
Thank you. And Bye. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Purdue University Physics and Astronomy Assistant Professor Dan Milisalovic is what he considers himself to be a reporter on the universe. And that's because he's done a lot of study into some things that have been out there for millions, maybe trillions of years, but we're just now starting to notice, in particular, about the supernova explosions and the remnants of supernovas. And we have him here to talk more about his research and some of the things that he has had a chance to see, in particular, a couple of supernovas that you probably have already heard about. And we'll call you Professor Dan. Professor Dan, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Chris, it's a delight to be here with you. Thank you.
One of the things I know that you primarily get to do is in your scholarly work is to take a look at and to be able to try to understand supernova explosions. And you mentioned that this is a really, really good time for astronomers, and a lot of that is because the technology is so advanced compared to what it has been.
Absolutely. In the universe, although we don't see it, actually a supernova takes place approximately every second. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I joke, can you hear it?
Well.
Right. Supernova going off every second. And while many of those, the majority, are too far to see, our technology, which means the telescopes being used and the detectors that go at the end of them to be able to record the photons coming through, are improving significantly. And we're able to investigate increasing numbers of those supernova explosions.
Now, if you do happen to see the remnants of a supernova, actually get to see one with your eyes, that is, it's been taken through a telescope, we're talking about an event that happened, you know, as I said, trillions of years ago, right? It's not real time. It's past, way past time, isn't it?
The age of the universe is just under 14 billion years, but it's expanded in that time. So, in fact, it can be a larger distance than that as far as the time that it takes for light to arrive from the most distant element. So that's one of the funny things in astronomy, mm-hmm. right? Light has a finite velocity, and so it actually takes time to traverse the huge distances associated with the universe. Now, you said trillions. I will correct you there. Mm-hmm. We think the universe to be just under 14 billion years old, so it's not quite that many years ago. Okay. But it is often the case that the supernovae that I investigate did occur many, many years ago, and that's a function of how distant they are in the unit that we use of light years, and they can be very, very far.
What I know that you do in your work is something that that is, I guess, if you want to look for some way to describe it, is something that's called time domain astronomy. And that's really, that's a term that actually comes, from the 20th century, but with the new technology in the 21st century, it's being observed a lot more, is it not?
Well, the technology, going back to that, has enabled us to be able to monitor the universe at an increasing cadence. So originally, if we go back hundreds of years ago, it was thought that the universe was static and mostly unchanging. But it was actually a galactic supernova, so a supernova that happened in our own galaxy, the Milky Way, that demonstrated that the universe changes. And so fast forward now to recent times. Instead of observing the sky every couple of months and looking for changes in galaxies to see if a star has exploded in a supernova explosion, we're now getting to the point where it's as often as a nightly return to the same patch of sky to see if there's a difference from one night to another. Mm-hmm. Some all-sky surveys are even doing this within the same night, to look on timescales of a few hours to capture the first moments when that star has exploded.
I know that you've done some groundbreaking work on a couple supernova phenomena, and one in particular which has been well documented and, in fact, written about. I know National Geographic even did an article in one of its issues not too many months ago. Some time ago, I guess, on what is called Cassie or Cassiopeia A, which is, I guess, a supernova in the constellation Cassiopeia. And tell us about what you discovered, I guess, in the report that you helped put out about that, and what you discovered with the observations and with the instruments that you used at that time.
Right. So one has to remember that because these objects are so far away, in the case of Cassie, it's approximately 11,000 light years away. So the light that's arriving is 11,000 years old. Let's take that. And I guess going back to the time aspect, it's almost like a time machine because we're looking back in time when we make these observations. But put that aside, when we look at objects that are so distant, it's not like I can change my angle or perspective, right? I have this face-on view, and it limits what I can how I can understand the three-dimensional shape of the object. Okay? But what we're able to do using spectroscopy, we can measure the velocity of the gas. And because all that gas originated from a star at some point, and then there's a kaboom that ejected that gas, and it follows ballistic trajectories. So the gas that is furthest out from the center of expansion is moving faster than material that is closer in. We can do a three-dimensional reconstruction of that supernova remnant. And that's what we did in those series of papers, where we took this 2D image and were able to make a three-dimensional kind of CAT scan. And that now allows us to investigate the kinematic and chemical properties of the explosion. And I liken it to kind of a bomb squad investigation. Okay, so I've been told that a bomb's gone off in a room. What am I going to do? First thing I'm going to do is scan the perimeter and see how the debris has been oriented, right? Maybe it's just along one axis like it would be in a pipe bomb. The next thing I would do is to scrape off that material off of the wall and then do some kind of analysis to see what the bomb was made up of. This is what I can do with the gas as well. I can do a chemical analysis to know what components went into the original explosion.
Now, in your work at Purdue University, you have great opportunities, I know, with some of the latest technology that's available there on the West Lafayette campus. And in doing some of your work, and I know you work in particular with the Envision Center on the West Lafayette campus, working on some of these reconstructions. Like you say, it's been able to piece something together. Tell us about what kind of tools you get to work with to be able to reach what you're doing right now.
So, since coming to Purdue, I have been very fortunate to work with some brilliant people who know how to use virtual reality much better than I do. Mm-hmm. And to take those three-dimensional reconstructions away from a 2D screen, right, and actually put it in a virtual environment so that you put a headset on and you can be completely immersed in the experience. I mean, it's kind of like having a starship. All of a sudden, we can travel to Cassay and float around, right? And I'll say, to be able to fully appreciate a three-dimensional shape, right, you need to have agency in your perspective, which is to say, you need to move your head around, go up and down, or even actively manipulate the object in front of you, have a true spatial understanding of what's in front and what's in back. Now, if I gave you just a picture of an apple even, right, you already know what it looks like on the other side because you've had experience with apples, but what if you're giving it to an alien, somebody who's never seen that before? They don't know what the other side is. So having that agency and being able to rotate it around in a virtual environment is very empowering. And beyond that, what we're doing is making it not just an isolated individual experience, like so much of virtual reality is presently, but a collaborative endeavor. So we can have multiple people in the same virtual environment interacting with the supernova remnant reconstruction. This becomes both a research tool. So I can investigate it with collaborators. I can bring in multiple supernova remnants and compare and contrast their morphology. And I can use it as a teaching tool. So I can have students come in and point out the morphology in order to instruct them on supernova explosion processes.
Do you think that the technology that you're working with the virtual reality technology, based in and how you've been able to discover more than just looking at 2D images. Do you think this is an opportunity that the average person someday will be able to have, to be able to look at something more than just a picture that maybe that the Jet Propulsion Labs or NASA may have put together that we see that's out there now to look at online?
Chris, that is an excellent question. I'm glad you brought that up. That is precisely what our goal is. Mm-hmm. And we are actually targeting deployment on low-cost, I guess what you would call entry-level VR products. So, for instance, a lot of our development right now is with the Oculus Quest, which goes for, I think, $300 right now. It's a wireless headset, so you don't have to be tethered to anything. You put it on, and you can be connected to potentially the person next to you, or you could be connected to somebody in another city, another state, another country, and be immersed in this VR experience simultaneously at a reasonable price point. And so I really do think that the technology has progressed enough where we're just around the corner from where this will be a more common experience for people.
I know you mentioned that you have the opportunity and have in the past with being able to work with professional astrophysicists and astronomers around the world, either, you know, by working with your own particular set of VR, I suppose, or just, you know, by just regular work in the past, but maybe even to the average individual. You mentioned there are amateur astronomers all around the world. We know that I guess it help out what they see and help catalog what they see up there that you get to work with in your research. And so you think this is just an extension of what's been done in the past, only we've just brought it more, further into the 21st century.
Another interesting point. So, yes, I do work I don't like the expression amateur astronomer.
Right.
Because these aren't really amateurs. It's just that they have other day jobs, and then their other job at night is doing astronomy. So one of the individuals I've had a long relationship with is Stuart Parker in New Zealand. He is a world-acclaimed supernova discoverer. I think his total is up over 150 supernovae that he himself has discovered. I mean, you can't call that an amateur, especially with the amount of money they invest in this, right? You can buy a fancy car, or you can buy a pretty sophisticated telescope and be able to do some cutting-edge research that supports the professional community.
Well, Professor Dan, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about an interesting topic. We've all seen the pictures. We've seen, I guess, even the false color images that may have come from JPL or from NASA of the supernova explosions or the remnants of the supernova explosions. But it'll be even more wonderful to get to see them in some type of virtual reality. I'm sure we're looking forward to what comes up next in the research that's being able to be done at Purdue University, and hope that you're not only ahead of everybody else and at the head of that research, but you'll be able to reveal more of it to us today.
Hey, that's great. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Dan Milisavljevic is an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at Purdue University on the West Lafayette campus. And this is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks much for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.